Hola, hola, and welcome back to another episode of Señora Power. This is Sophia.
This is Sonia.
And this is Gabby.
And this is part three of episode three, our Activist Señoras Plática. So in today's episode, we're going to give you a little recap of our Activist Señoras, María Jiménez and Alicia Escalante. We're going to be discussing what activism has looked like in Texas and California, its similarities and differences. We're going to be talking about intersectionality, how lived experience influences the señoras' participation in political spaces. So we're excited to get into it. I hope you're ready. So let's begin this plática. The first question that I have for you all is, you know, let's talk about activism and the different ways in which activism is carried out in both Texas and California. What have we learned about the differences and similarities between how these two señoras have conducted their activism?
I think that in California, Señora Escalante had different networks that were already established in community organizing through the Chicano movement. So I'm thinking about Católicas por la Raza as like an organization that she worked with when she was at the St. Basil's protest, and they helped with some of her welfare activism. She also, I believe, went to the Poor People's Campaign. And she was just a part of a lot of the civil rights organizing that was happening at the same time that she was doing her welfare activism. So I think having that organizing infrastructure that she was working within allowed her to focus on the marginalized populations that she did.
Yeah, for Maria Jimenez, she kind of wore a lot of hats, so to speak, during her professional career. She was mostly known, especially towards the end of her life, as an immigrants' rights organizer. And because of her personal like identity and the way she organized, she was very transnational, crossing the border to Mexico at a certain point in her life and organizing in Mexico. So I think that her organizing in Texas really bears that mark of transnationalism, but also shows kind of the Tejano identity in a lot of ways that has to do with more recent migration, that has a lot to do with the hybridity or uncertainty of calling yourself Mexican, American, and maybe or maybe not Chicano, Chicana. And I think, you know, Maria did at some points, I think, identify as Chicana, but she identified as a community organizer first and foremost, and as a Mexicana. And so I think that that's really important for the Texas organizing identity, is the idea of having to understand what your populations identify as and meet them at that point, because, you know, the Chicano identity is very much a political alignment for a lot of people, especially in Texas. Not a lot of people, especially of Señora Jiménez's generation, felt like they could identify as Chicano, Chicana, especially if they weren't specifically farm workers. So I think that María Jiménez's activism legacy in Texas has a lot to do with being specifically in Texas, even though she was going to national conferences, very well versed in what the national dialogue was around immigrants' rights. I think she was also a very good organizer in that she listened and she was actually part of the community she was organizing. So there was a lot of that informing the way that she identified and the way that she organized. And so you can see that Texas mark very clearly in that it was very kind of issues oriented rather than identity oriented for a long time.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that whenever I think about the Chicano movement and all of the institutions and organizations that aligned with it back in the 60s and 70s. I always think about, you know, students in California and like the school movement in California. But here we have the example of Maria Jimenez, who was very much involved with like the University of Houston and with like the college system in Texas, right? So that's definitely, as Gabby was saying, an issue-based kind of activism, which had to do with, you know, representation of Chicanos and Mexican Americans and Tejanos in the school boards and the school systems. She was also very involved, though, with like migrant workers. She did a lot of work around undocumented people, right? And then at the same time, my Alicia Escalante in California, she was very much like attuned to the political realm. She was writing to all sorts of people. She was very much a political activist, right? So I don't know, different representations of how the Chicano movement happened in both Texas and California, and how each of our señoras are kind of defying the usual narrative that we have for these two locations in a way. But I think it's also important to talk about, you know, how each of these señoras is carrying out her activism. So how do they navigate the expectations of their roles in within their community? How the two señoras position themselves in relation to their activism?
I will say we mentioned political. I think that that's like a pretty fraught term, especially when like talking about female, like women organizers and women activists. I think that also just to note that Maria Jimenez was asked to run for office by the Raza Unida Party in the 80s, and she did, and she did win that race. So she was very much ingrained in politics. I think that in California at the time, perhaps politics were coalescing more readily around identity. Like there was, like the Raza Unida Party had a bigger presence. Like there was the idea of, like, we need to get someone who represents us no matter who they are in a lot of ways. There was a lot of activist work in California to try to do that groundwork of like, yes, this person aligns with our politics as well. But I think that you see the legacy in that it was very important to see people from the community being represented as elected officials. In Texas, that was still, I think, it was a newer thing. I think it was more like still about backing candidates who existed who would help the community's agenda. But anyway, I just wanted to bring in that part of Maria Jimenez's story that was a little bit more political, but talking about expectations about, is that what, is that, was that the question? I'm sorry.
Well, the question was like, what do these, how do these women navigate the expectations of community organizing? And from what we learned about Maria Jimenez is she didn't want to be called a leader. Like she didn't see herself as somebody who's taking charge, even though she won, like as you're saying, she won the Raza Unida Party seat. She still didn't feel like she was a political leader. She didn't like claim that title because she was much more invested in a horizontal relationship with power, which just means sharing among other people and not labeling herself as the holder of that power that can disseminate it to others. And so I think Jimenez walked that line of wanting to be called an organizer, leading, but not being called a leader. Whereas Escalante is a lot different to that, I would say.
I am just still obsessed with how Escalante signs off on her letters. Hasta la victoria, sin más. Things like that, you know, so you can tell that she's like a force to be reckoned with. It's like Alicia Escalante, you better know that name, right? Whereas I feel like Maria Jimenez is, yes, of course, you know Maria Jimenez's name, but you also focus mostly on like the communities and the organizations in which she was involved. Not to say this is not the case for Alicia Escalante, right? But I think that there's a different way in which they each position themselves as either like a leader who does not want to be a leader but still does the work of leading versus like someone who has to take on that leadership role, because otherwise perhaps no one else would. I mean, lots of other women would probably, but she was the one to take it on. And I think that that's the important thing to note about Escalante.
Yeah, I mean, I think too, there's a difference in the way that Señora Escalante and Señora Jiménez interpreted their lived experiences. So Alicia Escalante had a very difficult life in a lot of ways that had to do with her being perceived as a woman, her being perceived as less than because of her gender, and also less than because of being a mother. It's this complexity of, especially in the Chicano movement, I bring this up because Maria Jimenez has a very explicit quote about it as well, but the fact that in the Chicano movement in the 60s and 70s, a lot of women noted, you're only respected if you're a mother, right? Or a virgin. But even if you're a mother, and I think Alicia's experience showed us this, it was only a superficial kind of respect for a lot of women, because it said, okay, you're a madrecita, that's great. Like, you know, you should embody all of these things. But when you step out of line, when you need more help, when you still want to retain your independence, but also take care of your children, that's when you're no longer readable to us. That's when I, as a man, for example, no longer understand what you're trying to do. And also why, you know, then the question was also, why are single mothers' struggles seen as secondary in that time period if mothers were so respected? So I think that, you know, bringing all this to light, or to the forefront, you see that Alicia's journey was really fraught with gaining respect in order to change her situation. So in that regard, I think I would see, I would understand if she said, I want to be like acknowledged as a leader. I want to be acknowledged as a thought partner of communities. I want to be acknowledged as an activist. And I think that's really fair. And you know, also understanding her legacy of going into activism and being arrested and having the book thrown at her when no one else was arrested that long, being jailed because she was seen as such a threat. So all of that, I think, would make it understandable for her to want to stand out as a leader. On the other side, Maria Jimenez was somebody who learned early on that coalition building relies on you kind of fading into the background in a lot of ways. And coalition building was what helped her get things done. This also might have been the moment in time and the geographical location where these two señoras were organizing as well. Because Maria Jimenez said that she recognized very early on this dichotomy or this thing, this paradox of how men in the movement saw her, where it was like, I have to make sure to stand apart from them. And she was not a young mother at the time. So she also had the option to say, like, I'm just one of the dudes at the time. And so I think part of that made her leadership style be less of, I want to stand out, and more of, I want to work within the community, be a community organizer, look for these horizontal kind of level connections. It's also worth noting that Señora Escalante was older than Maria Jimenez. So Maria Jimenez was actively organizing in the 70s and 80s, while Alicia Escalante started actively organizing in the 60s. So these also, I think a lot of these things, and I bring this up just because women, a lot of the times when you want to be seen as a leader, it's seen poorly, right? It's seen in a bad way. And I think that these two women show the complexity of what it means to be an effective activist. You can want to be seen as a leader. You can not want to be seen as a leader. Both are valid and effective. And I think I wanted to bring up what happened recently in an interview with Kamala Harris, because basically in this interview, it was brought up that a political opponent who identifies as a woman had said, my children keep me humble. I don't know what keeps Kamala Harris humble. I guess putting aside for now the kind of blatant ignoring of non-biological family. I think that, you know, Kamala Harris's response was interesting in that she said, I don't aspire to be kept humble or to be seen as humble. And that's something that I see very much in Alicia Escalante's leadership style of saying, like, I refuse this push to be seen as a humble, subservient woman. But I also see it in Maria Jimenez's style as well, where she was willing to speak out when things were not going well. And she very much talks about her conscious decision to be an organizer, to fade into the background. It was not something that was imposed upon her. It was something that she wanted to take on.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to consider. Again, this is kind of like the point of our podcast, right? To consider each of these señoras as kind of like being very situated within their time periods, but also, you know, what they're doing differently within that same social and political context, right? As Gabby was pointing out, both of these señoras are working very firmly within the Chicano movement and like the broader umbrella of the Chicano movement. However, it looks differently for Escalante in the 60s versus Jimenez in like the 70s and even like the 80s, right? So I don't know, maybe we can talk about, you know, how both of these señoras were working with kind of like not the traditional Chicano populations, right? As Gabby suggested, Escalante was working with basically working mothers on welfare. And then we know from Maria Jimenez's activism that she was very into like intersectional coalition building. So for me, this brings up the question of, you know, what are minoritized or marginalized populations within this time period, within the scope of the Chicano movement? How are these señoras paying attention or enacting some sort of like intersectional activism in multiple ways, right? Not just in a racial way, but also in the terms of like different kinds of Chicanos that the movement, or Chicanas that the movement was not even considering at the time. So yeah, I wonder if y'all want to say anything about that.
Yes, because Señora Escalante came into activism through healthcare activism, organizing. Specifically, her doctor told her to go to a protest that was trying to advocate against cuts that Reagan was making to essentially Medicare, what we understand Medicare to be now, but within California. And so I think it was there that she saw lots of different kinds of people who had been marginalized within the healthcare system, which you can kind of define as they had certain abilities, experiences, and situations that were not being accounted for in legislation. So they were marginalized, or they were a minority in the policies that were being made, and they are not in power, and they are having to protest in order to have their voice heard. That's how I would kind of get at the minoritized and marginalized populations. And I think that intersectional activism is understanding that power is located across different identities and different lived experiences, and that they interlock in different ways and in different spaces. And so Escalante came into activism heavily aware that Chicanas, or the Chicano movement, is not the only space where somebody has been marginalized or experiencing injustice. And so she also worked with a Black Women Solidarity Group, the NWRO. And so she was hyper aware, I think, of the ways that women are experiencing disability injustice, Black injustice, gendered injustice. And so she understood that under the umbrella of welfare, all of these different experiences and identities were being dismissed, undervalued, and punished in many ways by the welfare system. So I think that's what her intersectional activism looked like. And a lot of women at that time were becoming increasingly aware as they entered spaces like the Poor People's Campaign that other people were experiencing police brutality, for example. Other people were experiencing similar kinds of injustice, but they didn't know it until they were able to share their experiences with each other and meet in these community organizing spaces to connect and to see the structural inequity across states, across nations, across identities.
Yeah, I also think that with these two women, you see very like issue-based organizing. So, you know, single mothers on welfare, immigrants' rights. And for Alicia Escalante, part of that ended up being kind of identity-based because single mothers on welfare is inherently kind of a gendered issue. I think Maria Jimenez, she herself had this kind of knowledge of her intersectionality, especially because of her approach in organizing, trying not to be a leader. I think when you are trying not to be perceived in that way, you are very conscious of the way that you are perceived. And so she, I think, was very conscious of, okay, this is how gender works. This is how, you know, race works. This is how class works here. And for her, because it was very much about getting immigrants' rights, like getting them rights, it was more about that. And I think in a certain way, sometimes this can, you know, this can be beneficial. And sometimes it can be perhaps like a challenge when organizing and you are so focused in on one thing. But she ended up being part of the effort to organize for like all immigrants' rights. She started out only with Mexican nationals, but then she expanded to kind of all immigrants. And there was, I think, a lot of what she brought to the table that was really important. And this is why her technique was mostly like, I'm going to listen and I'm going to facilitate. I'm going to try to make myself obsolete. Because once she moved outside of the Mexican community, there was less of her lived experience that she could bring to the table. And I think that's why her strategy was really smart for what she was doing. But I think that in terms of intersectionality, you mostly see it in her story when she's talking about her own experience, when she's talking about having to go and be in activist circles and also be perceived as a woman in whatever way that showed up for people.
I wonder if college campuses in particular lend themselves to this listening. You know, like, I think the institution Jimenez was working in kind of allowed her to sit in on conversations and then learn from them and then help advocate with them, not for them. And I think, you know, as people who have been on college campuses, they can be a unique space in that way. And so I wonder if that's part of her intersectional activism as well.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels that way just because she was able to sit in on so many of these different like student-based organizations and, you know, listen to them, learn from them, and then work with them for this kind of coalition building that she's focused on. But I mean, I don't know this. I don't think it's inherently the case, right? After all, academia is an institution and some professors just like to hear themselves speak. Right. And so I think that we should not be crediting the institution for this kind of like space. I think we should be crediting the organizations that made it so and like the señora activists that made it so. But I think this all goes back to like their own particular lived experiences, right? And how they're using their lived experience to carry out their activism. And I think that, you know, Jimenez is very much embedded within the college system. So, yeah, I mean, there's something inherent about the discussion moment, the kind of like community of learners kind of thing. And there's also the fact, I think, that Jimenez already had an example of like student-based activism coming out of California. So there's some, I think there's something to be said there, too, about what she learned from that movement and its particular focus on like leadership and versus how she carried out her own student-based activism as a participant and not a leader, right? But I wonder if we can talk a little bit about Escalante's own lived experience and what propelled her to become an activist in that way?
I mean, like I mentioned earlier, the healthcare system was one that she struggled with at an early age. I think a lot of her lived experience is connected to her mother, like a lot of our señoras. Her mom was incredibly subservient, was the quintessential sort of quiet, docile, demure Mexican woman. And I think everybody was astonished when she left her abusive husband. And Escalante took note of all of that. And she used those lived experiences to advocate for different kinds of women who didn't grow up in a culture where they felt that was possible or didn't have the tools to do that, maybe didn't have the language. And specifically, her mom had some healthcare issues brought on by the kind of manual labor that she was doing. And so Escalante connected her mom's disabilities to the healthcare system, to the gendered sort of realms where women are sort of punished for the decisions that they make within society. So she's like doing all of that kind of connecting work via her mom's story and the advocating she had to do for her mom because she did speak English, but she was just incredibly shy, incredibly self-conscious about her English. And I think that's a really valid experience to have that a lot of people still have today. And Escalante, maybe that's part of like her leadership aspect, right? Is as a kid, she had to become her parents' advocate. And that can really push you into a leadership role. It pushes you into a parenting role, which is also kind of a leadership role. So I think that's where her lived experiences meets her activism in some ways.
I think what surprises me about Jimenez, or I think at the beginning it surprised me about Jimenez, and now it's just kind of something I admire about her, is that she talks about her lived experiences. And in a way, when you look at her activist legacy, you kind of wouldn't know a lot of her lived experience. And that's, going back to her effort to not be the center of attention. That's, again, we've spoken about how there's a lot of valid approaches, especially being a woman in the public eye. I think that there's a lot of valid approaches to doing that. But I think that Jimenez, when you looked at her lived experience, it's very obvious how it affected her activist career, especially when you look at how she learned a lot of what she calls a lot of her feminism from her mother and her grandmother before she understood it to be feminism, and when her mother and grandmother did not understand it to be feminism, but they were just living their lives, surviving, and advocating for themselves, I think quite effectively, because they wanted their work in the household realm to be understood as work, as labor, especially in a family that was made up of labor organizers. They wanted their work as kind of mothers of the family to be seen as labor. And Jimenez learned that. So I think that that's actually a really valuable lesson that we can still understand as a radical ideology today. And Jimenez, I think, took that learned experience, lived experience, and brought it into the academic institution as well. I think that that's something I can see, even if she might not have explicitly said it, but I can see as something that gave her strength going forward into the fights that she was a part of, especially when she was going up against a lot of privileged groups in the university that didn't understand Maria's positionality. Like, for them at that time, it was wild to see a woman going so far in an academic institution, specifically a Mexican woman. Like, they were not expected to be there. The proof of this is that she applied to a scholarship and was denied it on the basis of the fact that she was Mexican. Like, they were about to give it to her, but they're like, oh, wait, actually, you're Mexican. Like, we're not giving it to you. That to me is very strange, obviously. But it's part of her lived experience that fueled her energy for the fights that she she was part of going forward, especially for her coalition building. She's very honest at the end of her life about how she did not agree with a lot of the people that she built coalitions with in earlier parts of her career. So when she was in college, she had to build coalitions with white people who had already kind of shown her that their ideologies did not match with hers. However, in order to get to where she was in the end, she had to, in some ways, learn how to harness their goals in service of her community's goals. And that's something that's very hard to do. And I think a lot of coalition work breaks down because, in the end, it's difficult to meld together radical ideologies. Like, it's very hard. And Jimenez had a talent for this. And so I sense in her story that she had a very intense, burning need to see justice happen because of her lived experiences of living through injustice. But she understood her role as having to be more restrained or having to be strategic about when she spoke out about things. And I wish I knew how to do that.
I just wanted to add to some of the early stuff that you were talking about with feminism, because I relate so heavily to that experience. I also have like tias and my mom and different older women who would never identify as a feminist or would never say this is a feminist ideology. Like, those words would never leave their mouths. But when you put it in conversation with feminism, it is actually, it's like the roots of feminism. It's not like the theoretical high theory part of it. It's not like, you know, the framework that we understand feminism to be as academics. It's actually like the seeds of it, the roots of it, the sort of foundation of where it comes from is like these women's lived experiences where they were pushing back on sexism, on racism, on all these different sort of injustices. And so I really relate to her sort of like pulling on her female ancestry to like help her navigate college. I think that's an experience I share. I think a lot of people probably share that as well. And so it's just really, I think, important to share that part of it because it's still very true and it's still an incredibly common strategy to navigate institutions.
And I want to uplift it also as the positive legacy of Señora Power, like the concept of Señora Power, being that you might not have a vocabulary for what you're doing or for this kind of strength that you're bringing to female family members or to women family members, but you are there as an example and as a leader. And that makes it possible for younger women in your family to survive and to thrive. And so I think that is something that I see as a positive legacy of Señora Power.
Maybe we should advocate for people to drop the term feminism and move over to like using Señora Power as the main kind of like movement rhetoric. No, I'm just kidding. But
hot take, spicy.
Not self-serving at all.
Not at all. It's not about us, guys. No, but I think that, you know, what y'all are saying is so true. Like, there's a way in which feminism becomes a bad word nowadays just because it's so tied to like theories and ideas and abstract concepts and things like that. And, you know, I often tell my students, like, it's not like the patriarchy is like this cloud that's hanging up over us, or like feminism is like this abstract concept that we just talk about. I tell them that it's based on like practices, right? And I think what both of these señora activists teach us is that feminism is a practice, is the act of advocating for yourself, for your community, for different communities, and just being an active participant within all of these different kind of marginalized and minoritized and oppressed groups. And Señora Power then comes in as this like action of reclaiming this action of advocating, this action of coalition building across differences, right? So yeah, we're bringing it back down to the practice of Señora Power and the practice of being in community. And I mean, just to conclude this episode, what we've learned from these two señoras in putting them, and from all of the señoras that we've been putting in conversation across Texas and across California, is that, you know, these are only two señoras that we're focusing on among a broader network of other kinds of señora activists that might have gone unrecognized for a long time because their particular kind of señora activism doesn't quite look like the political activism that we're used to seeing. So, you know, in the archives of both of these señoras, we've found so many letters, so many notes, so much correspondence between the two of them, between other kinds of señoras. There's so many names that have emerged throughout this archive. And so it's very, very clear that it's a network of feminist señora activists that that are working together, and that we should, you know, continue to honor their legacy and continue to learn from them, from this genealogy of señora power. So anything else either of you want to say in this episode?
Hasta la victoria.
Sin más.
And with that, we thank you for joining us in another episode of Señora Power. Stay tuned for more.